Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Dinosaur Jr. It's officially been 20 years since grunge, and if that makes you feel old, you are not alone. The side streets and back alleys of Kansas City were home to lots of hidden little music venues back then, not to mention coffee shops and record stores where the sounds of all kinds of subgenres of alternative rock bled through the walls. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we'll take a look back at the music of the 90s. Was there such a thing as a Kansas City sound? And what is the legacy of grunge in Kansas City and beyond? That's coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman and we are here today to talk about, well, grunge 20 years later, as well as 90s alternative rock movements in Kansas City and elsewhere, but mostly in Kansas City. My guests today are Amy Farrand, a local musician who played in a handful of memorable 90s bands, none of which would probably be considered grunge, but all of which easily count as alternative and underground. Amy was deeply involved in the music scene then and remains one of its mobilizing forces today. Among her many claims to fame is her role organizing the Weirdo Wednesday Supper Club, a quarterly variety show at Davies Uptown Rambler Club. Good morning, Amy.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also here with Steve Tulipana, co-founder and co-owner of the Record Bar, as well as a musician. In the 90s, Steve was in a rock band that was one of Kansas City's musical exports, Season to Risk. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So can anyone here take a stab at defining grunge?
I think it was really an industry term. I really do. I think it was one of those terms that was used as just sort of a canopy, like Americana, or maybe not Americana. That's way bigger than grunge, but still, or alternative, or something like that. Industry term to have a slot to put that record in at the store.
I think when we were first starting, we were young. We called it, everything was punk rock. If it wasn't on the radio, it was punk rock, and. Speaking of grunge, just last night, the surviving members of Nirvana were on Jimmy Fallon's show, and they were saying this. They didn't talk about grunge, but they were saying, "Well, punk rock. We were into punk rock, and it was the same thing." And like she says, I agree that it was a term, a catch-all phrase. Maybe in Sub Pop or the Northwest was like gritty. It was like punk rock taking more 70s Sabbath sounds, you know, and then. Then it became this industry term that was anybody that was underground or
anybody with ripped pants.
Yeah. Well, then it became fashion, and then it's still on the runways. You know, it's like
hot, totally super hot.
Do you guys think so? Could you identify any musical styling, any particular underpinning that you would think of as like? But most of the things that we would call grunge, or that someone would have called grunge, had this characteristic or that characteristic.
Loud, sloppy guitars, and you know, rock bands. It was a version of punk. I want to keep going back to that same thing. And I find, you know, you ask us about this to come here, and there are very few bands in our town, I think, that would fit into the grunge category at that time.
That's very interesting.
I think
that no one really ever aspired. To like, hey, let's start a grunge band. I mean, there probably were some bands.
There are a couple I remember.
That's kind of switched over and went, hey, well, let's kind of define our sound, but I don't know if I'd want to peg anybody with that, you know, because that was just a perception.
It's so funny because I do feel like, and you're kind of hinting at this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like some of these words are kind of embarrassing. And like grunge in particular, no disrespect to any of the musicians, but the second I say that word, a little piece of my pride dies a little bit, and I don't entirely know why. Do you know why?
When the Season of Risk's first record came out, we approved the artwork. It was by this great poster artist, Frank Kozik. I mean, we approved that. We were happy with that. But then we got the records, and they had a sticker that Columbia had tagged on it, and it said, the quote was from some review, and it said, a slammin' punk grunge thang with an A in it.
Oh,
I mean, grunge was already like bummed us out, but the thang really, really bummed us. I mean, we were so livid with, but again, it was an industry thing that we, you know, they didn't think they needed to prove how they were going to sell it. You know what I mean?
So it sounds like we're coming to the conclusion here, at least among the people in this room, that this was kind of a marketing term placed on musicians from the outside more than that came from the musician's self-identification. But
right. I'm sure somebody in a suit somewhere in an office who, you know, came up with the term. Like, what do we call these guys?
Yeah.
We don't want to call them punk because we want it to be marketable to these suburban kids who have the money.
Well,
what do we want to call them?
The crazy thing at that time, the major labels went on a A&R spree, and they weren't suits. They were a bunch of college kids. They went to all the college radios, and that's who was coming up with this stuff. And
you think that's who came up with the term?
What's A&R?
Artist and Repertoire. They were people that would work with the artists. They were kind of the liaison between the artists and the labels, and they would suggest things, you know.
But I just picture a boardroom or you know, a table with everybody sitting around going, I don't know, what do we call this? It's got to sound cool.
But did the musicians, I mean, did either of you as musicians benefit from this phenomenon at all, or was it sort of something outside of your world that you could kind of like stand back and look at it the way that any music fan did?
I started playing in rock bands. I started playing live shows when I was 15 years old. And there have been very few bands that I've been in my life that I wouldn't consider a punk band in some way. So, you know, even, punk is a lot of attitude more than music stylings, I think. And so I was never put off by the punk label, ever.
And what about grunge?
I'm with her on this,
You know, like, it was like a fluff term or something. I don't know, a catch-all for something loud that no one knew how to describe. Or,
you know, I think it was fine for some bands. You know, there were some bands out there that it made sense, I suppose. But I never felt it was that way for my band, you know. But we did benefit from it. I mean, I think the fact that they had the success they had in 93, really, or 92 was
two,
when
92.
When it really blew up. And it allowed, like, you know, the labels, the major labels, to go out and ravage small scenes, you know, and try to sweep up a bunch of people, throw it against the wall, and see what stuck or what did well. And, you know, I think it was good for some people. For me, I'm like, you know, we sold some records. We didn't get majorly huge, but we had a lot of great, cool opportunities that I had a blast. And I still, it affected what I still do today, you know.
You did quite a bit in the 90s. You guys showing up in movies and 90210.
That stuff wouldn't have happened without Nirvana breaking, you know. But I think it hurt a lot of regional bands as well.
How
too.
Did it hurt regional bands?
There were, I mean, expectations like, oh, well, you're, you know, this is a major label dilemma. You know, this has nothing to do with the independent labels. You know, if you're an underground band and you get signed to a major label, you immediately lose all cred.
Know,
you have to operate at a certain level or else you're in the no man's land.
Right. And then, there's a buffer zone between I still have street cred a little bit. I'm still really edgy, but Sony wants to sign me. But I'm still going to be really.
But I still have holes in my knees.
Still have holes in my pants.
Yeah. But I think, you know, if. But that thing where it hurt some bands, if you don't have a thick skin, you just kind of, a lot of people walked away from music. I know a lot of people that had some, you know, across the country that had some mid-level success like that. Yeah. And they were like, the label's like, well, they didn't sell enough. Well, let's drop them. And then they just quit instead of, we have thick skin and we consider ourselves punk rock, or we
did. That's right.
So we put out a few more independent label records and we still dabble, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, your band that you're referring back to is Season to Risk. Can you tell us about that band?
What would you like to know?
Well, tell us about how the band got started, when it got started, how you would describe its sound.
We first started in the fall of 89. We'd been playing in other punk rock bands, playing out at the outhouse and different things. And When we started that band, it was actually we were trying to become a little like I'll be honest, we were trying to become a little less punk. We were trying to put a little more musicianship into what we were doing, and that's what we thought. Mm-hmm. And it became a little more of a crossover band. And when I look back in retro, I'm like, oh, I was talking to Tim Finn about this actually at South By, and I'm like, we were a metal band, and we never wanted to admit
totally
that.
Totally a metal band,
but we never wanted to admit it, you know.
Right.
But because we came out of punk, we wanted to play more, like, you know, really. If Soundgarden's a band that gets the label grunge, who I, you know, I guess the first couple records were pretty grungy, but they were a big influence and kind of like, well, those guys can play, like, you know, and I think that's kind of where we got into it, and it just the time was. You know, we were self-promoting shows. We were doing house shows and warehouse shows, and we did a lot of that stuff. And
you guys toured a lot, too. When you toured, did people see you as a Kansas City band or something else?
They did, you know. And the funny thing, I mean, we were KC cheerleaders always. KC Proud was our slogan, was on our records, and we were really proud to be from Kansas City and have this like Midwest work ethic. We're like, we're going to tour in a van. We don't need a bus. You know, we told Columbia no buses and, you know, blah, 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 whatever.
Van turned over on a frozen highway. Did you regret that at that moment?
I was driving. I totally regretted it.
Oh man.
It's terrifying. Amy, so Steve's talking about KC Proud.
Right.
Would you say that there was a Kansas City sound in terms of underground rock and roll here in town?
I do think so. It's a combination here in Lawrence, but I really do think so. And it's funny because people all over the country used to talk about the KC sound. Nobody could really define it. There were a few bands. Season of Risk was one of them. I would say Shiner and Molly Maguire and I don't know. Help me out, Steve. There are a few within that vein that were sort of the definition of that, sort of the influence.
All I can figure out, because that kept coming. We were talking about this on Facebook yesterday, and a lot of people chimed in. And they were talking about their travels. Like, people used to say this outside of the town. Something we never promoted because I never thought there was like.
It's hard to see yourself that way.
Right. But I think maybe using dissonant chords and some mathy, really good drummers.
Good drummers are important. Very good drummers are important.
Time signature changes.
Yeah, man.
Everything wasn't 4/4. Stuff was in 7/8 and going into...
And back and forth.
Yeah, and back and forth.
Yeah, why not?
If you're just tuning in, I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on kcur.org. Our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Call or tweet us to let us know whether you think there was such a thing as a Kansas City sound in the 1990s. Who embodied it, and how would you define it? Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 with your stories and memories. You'll be joining a conversation with two stalwart figures in Kansas City's music scene, Amy Farrand and Steve Tulipana, and I knew they'd get a kick out of that. But now I'd also like to introduce a national guest who is just now joining us by phone. His name is Ricky Rockman. He's most famous for hosting the Headbangers Ball on MTV. He's on the line now. He conducted a notorious interview with Nirvana during which an apathetic Kurt Cobain wore a yellow ball gown and dark sunglasses. Thanks so much for calling, Ricky. We're honored to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I've ever heard it notorious before, but I've definitely used the word apathetic to describe that interview.
Tell us about that interview, and then we'll sort of broaden our discussion.
Yeah, it was funny because at this point, I was a big Nirvana fan. I mean, I remember when Bleach came out, I didn't think of grunge, and I didn't think of Seattle sound. I just thought, wow, this record's really awesome. I really liked it. So when Nirvana finally came in, I was really excited to meet the guys in Nirvana because, you know, I'm not a musician. I'm a rock fan that luckily was in front of a camera. So I was very excited to meet Nirvana. I walked into the green room and Kurt Cobain was passed out face down in the green room. And I was like, okay, that sucks. So I just kind of went around, did my stuff. And then we did the show and he came out and he had obviously what a lot of people have seen, he had this big yellow ball gown. At this point, you know, I'm a fan of somebody, but if somebody doesn't even put the effort to have an engaging conversation or something, then I just kind of tune out. and he came out with this big ball gown. The interview was so boring, and I could tell he didn't want to be there. So when he didn't want to be there, I really didn't want him there. And I was a little bit disappointed because, as you know, if you're ever a big fan of somebody and then you go get to meet him, if that person lets you down, you're just like, oh, what a bummer, you know? So I never really got to talk to him at all at that point. And the interview was just, you know, some people say, oh, Ricky looked so uncomfortable. I wasn't uncomfortable. I was just like, oh, this is not going the way I wanted it to go because I was so excited. And at this time, Nirvana had not broke. This is Nevermind was just released. So, you know, the Headbangers Ball was one of the first people on MTV to start talking about Nirvana.
Well, Ricky, your background has a lot to do with metal, and Steve was just saying that his band, Season to Risk, had a little bit of a metal sound going on. What do you think is the relationship between grunge and metal?
The funny thing is most people think that my background is in metal, but the truth is when I was growing up in Los Angeles as a kid, all I listened to was LA punk rock. That's what I listened to. So I was part of the scene when the punk rock and I guess metal kind of got together, when you had your bands like your Guns N' Roses and from the UK, the Hanoi Rocks and stuff like that. That was kind of the scene that I got into. But I never liked categorizing music. I mean, Nirvana broke and a lot of people were really into it. But then as it got bigger and bigger, you know, we were playing them on the Headbangers Ball. So people were starting to think of them as a metal band. The same thing happened with a lot of the bands from that scene. I mean, with the Alice in Chains and the Soundgardens, and, you know, everybody was just pigeonholing it as the Seattle sound. And then somebody started using the word grunge. I don't remember when I first even started hearing the word grunge. I thought it was weird because, you know, I still to this day have a hard time describing if something is black metal, death metal, grindcore, or heavy metal, you know?
Yeah, you know, I'm hearing a really refreshing resistance to labels. So let's look back maybe without those labels and say, looking back at what was going on at this pivotal moment in the 90s, what do you think that pivotal moment, you know, what was before and what's after? Do you have a sense that there was a before and an after?
You mean before and after Nirvana?
Yeah, kind of.
I could not be more in the minority with the statement that I'm going to tell you, which is I do not think at all Nirvana killed the metal scene or the 80s rock scene. And, you know, they just had a big screening of The Metal Years at the Academy of Motion Pictures, and I said that there, and people, like a lot of people, were in disagreement, and they're still in disagreement. The way I look at it is if you belong to any type of music scene, whether it be heavy metal or glam metal or everything, and one band from Seattle comes and kills your scene, it means your fans are weak and it means the scene is weak. And the metal scene was not weak. It is not weak. Nirvana came out. They were playing a different type of music because that music became so popular, everybody started looking for that flavor. And everybody all of a sudden was dressing down and everybody was tuning down, you know, and everybody had a more droney sound. But I'm not going to ever say that the reason that people weren't buying certain bands is because people were Nirvana. I mean, Nirvana, just like when Guns N' Roses came out, everybody started dressing a little bit different and being a little harder and acting like bad boys, you know. So, but nobody ever said that Guns N' Roses killed the, you know, pretty boy rock scene. So nobody's ever said that.
Do you
but
look back?
Sure, love to say Nirvana killed it.
Do you look back at this time and this music and think of it differently now? That are there things that you've realized about it in retrospect that you didn't see at the time, that you didn't hear at the time?
Not necessarily Nirvana-wise. I mean, the times were, you know, every type of music from the metal genre spoke to different people and spoke at different times. Some were happy and let's go get chicks and party on a Saturday night, and some were like, you know, I'm not going to take this anymore, and almost spoke of the same angst as punk rock. I look at some of the songs that I thought were so great and so important. Well, man, these are just cheesy lyrics, you know. And I look at some of this stuff as being very goofy. But I remember, you know, I remember when, and since I know a lot of people are talking about Nirvana, I remember when In Utero came out. I couldn't stop playing that record, and I just loved the record. And never remember anybody saying, "Oh, you're listening to this band that killed metal." You know, I think back then we put a little. It's the most beauty, and I know that. You know, I know it was the same. I don't know if it's the same in Kansas City, but, you know, I've always lived in Hollywood. I'm a mile from the Sunset Strip right now. the music scene is completely dead, and people would go and support bands, and they really didn't even care what the band was. They're like, it's Saturday night, let's go to the Sunset Strip. And people don't do that anymore. You know, now they don't get off their ass to see anybody, and nobody supports music, and, you know, the live music scene is just dead.
Well, Ricky, before we let you go today, I want to get you talking a little bit to Steve Tulipana, because Steve, did your band performed at Ricky's Club? Is that right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Seasoned to Risk. Do you remember
which band
that
band?
It was called Seasoned to Risk. We played with. I just said it a while ago. I can't remember the name of the band.
Don't look at me.
It was one of the first shows that. Man, my brain is killing me right now. That Allison,
you definitely were at the Cat House.
Yeah.
Well,
if you can't remember, you were there.
I know, right?
the club, that
Circus
club
of Power.
Because that club,
Circus
of Power. There you go.
Circus of Power played there a bunch of times.
We opened for them once.
We had some great times. We had Alice in Chains play one time, and they brought a band to open up for them, which was Mookie Blaylock, which eventually became Pearl Jam. I mean, that club, which I was so lucky that, you know, I mean, people say, oh, you started the best rock club. No, I just opened up a rock club and just happened to be right place, right time, and everybody called that place home because we had so many incredible shows there. And one of the reasons that I was so excited to meet Nirvana was to walk in there and, you know, try to get Kurt to see if they would play the Cat House, because that's what I did. I went on Headbangers Ball and said, hey, you guys want to play my club in an unannounced show? And so that, you know, that since I know that Nirvana is a lot of the topic, is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and everything else.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Ricky. We enjoyed talking
with you. Oh, it
was great
talking to you guys.
That was Ricky Rockman. He, had the pleasure of interviewing, the pleasure or some might say displeasure of interviewing Kurt Cobain on maybe what was a bad day. But so I've noticed that our guests here today have been doing a lot of vigorous nodding during that conversation with Ricky. What really stood out to you about that?
Well, I like the story about the interview. And, you know, there's something to be said for a punk guy or that punk attitude. Not especially being into being interviewed, yeah. You know, not especially being into showbiz, which is it's an interesting trade-off because it's what you do. And I understand that's what you do. I mean, and to still eat and live indoors, you have to make money somehow, you know, and so there has to be some amount of promotion or something that you have to do. You have to let people know about you and, you know. I guess you just don't have to act like you care. I don't know, maybe. It's part of the persona, too. You
well,
know,
yeah, and talk about that persona.
Guy.
Talk about that persona that's part of that whole alternative rock 90s thing.
I mean, I think what Kurt did was not much different than what the Sex Pistols did when they first came out. And they were, like, you know, going on all these TV shows and being obnoxious. And it was a very similar type of, I think.
I'm here, but
MO.
I'm too cool to be here, first of all.
But really, it's just like,
it's funny.
Just boring Sydney.
Get it.
Well, before we go back to the Kansas City Sound, which I want to get right back to, I also want to talk to someone else who's with us from less afar than Ricky. She's from Lawrence. Kaveh, a musician based in Lawrence who has caught the attention of the Huffington Post, Spin, Esquire, and more for her hypnotic covers. Kaveh, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you created a video of yourself performing a cover of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box. That's gone incredibly viral. What inspired you to do that?
Well, it was actually a part of a Kickstarter cover series, you know, to raise funds for my next EP. And I do a lot of, you know, I do requests, you know, people back, you know, the project and they ask me to do a song. And you know, a lot of people ask me to cover Nirvana because, you know, they're an incredible band. And you know, this time I got to pick which song I wanted and I just picked whatever felt right.
Well, first of all, I want to go ahead and play the original Heart-Shaped Box. We'll talk about what you heard in that. We're just going to play a short clip from it, and then we'll hear a little bit of your cover.
Sure.
Let's start with a clip from Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box. And that's probably very memorable to some of our listeners and a little bit confusing to others. Kaveh, what did you hear in that that inspired you to want to do something different with it?
Well, I've always been a huge Nirvana fan, and I just, you know, his music is so honest and you know, just a lot of feeling to it. And I I could have picked any song, but I just, you know, for that moment in time, I just really kind of related and wanted to, you know, sing a song that made me feel something.
Well, let's hear how you covered that. This is Kaveh's Heart-Shaped Box.
Wish I could eat your kids too.
So tell us, first of all, what you're doing there. What are your tools? What are your instruments?
Well, I do a thing called live looping where I record every sound live just to kind of create. Since I'm only a one-person, you know, party, I always do these live loops so it can, you know, I feel like I'm playing with a band. And so I'm just using all of these different, like a MIDI keyboard and voice live just to kind of give me some, like, harmonies, and I just layer, just create, like, a huge, you know, portrait of layers.
Were you surprised that this cover became viral?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, practicing. I was going down to South by Southwest, and I was practicing some songs, and I had just gotten the voice I've touched, and I was just kind of, you know, like, halfway through a bottle of wine, just practicing, and my husband turned on the camera and was like, hey, I got new gear. Let's just test it out. And so I didn't think that this song would be viral the way it did.
Yeah. Well, what do you think it is? Do you think that there's something, I mean, I assume that your musicianship has a lot to do with that, but do you think there's something about this song at this moment in time in particular that's resonating with people, that maybe Nirvana speaks to people now in a way that is significant?
Definitely. You know, I think, you know, everyone can relate to, you know, a lot of the lyrics, his lyrics and his music, and especially during this point in time, I think it's definitely, you know, fresh in people's minds. But, you know, they're a band that will always be relevant, I think. And I think, you know, it wouldn't matter when you did one of their songs, when you covered one of their songs, because, you know, everyone, you know, knows who they are, and they're, you know, they're an important band for sure.
Something I notice in the difference between your cover and the original, I don't think I'd get a lot of argument if I said that subtlety was not a big feature of grunge, of Nirvana in particular. It was sort of like really, really straightforward. And I feel like you brought some subtlety to it. Can you maybe talk about the role of subtlety and what you were doing there?
Yeah, I just, I mean, I always, whenever I do covers, I always approach it as, you know, like Kurt Cobain's the man. I mean, I'm not going to do the song exactly like, you know, a genius would. I would try to do it from a different angle and come at it at a different perspective. And obviously being female, and, you know, I'm sure it helps a little bit to kind of be a little, you know, more delicate with it. But, you know, that's always how I approach it. And, you know, it's good to just kind of come at something at a different place.
Thanks so much for talking about this today. Where can people here see your video? They've heard a little bit of it, but where can they see it?
I'm on Vimeo and YouTube, and just find me at I Am Kaveh on Facebook or online for sure.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Kaveh, whose cover of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box went incredibly viral. She's in Lawrence. I want to get back to this question of the Kansas City sound in the 90s, because we have kind of, first of all, identified that the label grunge isn't one that came really from musicians, and that in addition to that, there were so many little sub-genres and sub-sounds going on in rock in the 90s that it's really helpful to kind of localize the conversation. We have already some callers who want to weigh in on that, and we'd love some more. 816-235-2888. If you think there was or was not a Kansas City sound in the 90s, we'd like to hear your perspective. But we're going to talk now with Joe in Kansas City. Hi, Joe.
Hi, this is Joe. And Steve, this is Joe Rose. I don't know if you remember me or not, but I was in a band called The Kents with Mike Devine. And we owned a rehearsal slash club called The Green Light down by Hallmark. I don't know if you remember that or not, but you guys in Sin City.
I do. It was right. It was on McGee, wasn't it?
It's just above City Spark Studios.
Yeah, it's
there
upstairs.
Joe.
Well, not above. It was
behind. You went around.
Behind it.
Yeah.
We've got some sound interference, so let's get to your question, and then we'll go ahead and discuss.
Yeah. So on the Kansas City sound and scene, it's really interesting, and just to get your perspective, we reminisce about this all the time. That was there a sound, or was it just a decoupage of different sounds? Because I just remember everybody being influenced by alt country, you know, Uncle Tupelo, and then from St. Louis and Belleville, you know, mixed with certainly grunge and Nirvana and blues, and Link Ray with Sin City, and then Seasoned Risk had this, you know, Basher Head, wall of sound. And I don't know that there really was a defined Kansas City sound, which was kind of the issue I remember coming up, is that labels would come by and not necessarily find the grunge scene, but they'd find, 20 different genres of music at any one night, depending on the club. So I'm just interested in your perspective, if you really, if there really was a Kansas City sound, or was it just a hodgepodge of different things?
That's an interesting question. I'd like you both to take that, actually.
I mean, I agree with Joe. The same, that's how I always felt. And the one cool thing about Kansas City is that, like you said, it would be a hodgepodge. You would put, bands that were different than each other together all the time. And not just because we didn't have enough of grunge bands. It was just because that's what we wanted to do, and we all supported each other. And that's one of the things that I've always said about Kansas City has been wonderful the whole time I've been doing stuff here, is that people really bond together and help each other out. Like, we were in Austin. Amy and I were in Austin a couple weeks ago for South by Southwest, and the Midcoast Takeover event just proves it, man.
That's just right.
100 bands of all different kinds of styles hanging out and getting on stage with each other. And it, I think it's always been like that back then, now.
I used to really love that about this town, is that you, no matter what the show was, it was a diverse lineup. And they were all ages clubs at that time. I mean, we're talking
name
about
some of those.
24. I was, you're talking about 20 years ago. I was 20. I'm 20 years old. I turned 20 years old in 1994. And, so I spent a lot of time at all ages clubs, although I was still playing in bars. I've been playing in bars since I was 15. I had a fake ID. I had all of it. I had to, because I would get tossed out of a bar. And I'd say, this band won't have a drummer if you toss me out. And they say, you better get it.
Yeah, there were
an F and ID. I'm like, all right, let me handle that. Yeah. So I did, And so let's see. All ages club, of course, Rumba Box.
Rumba Box. Green Lady Lounge.
Green Lady Lounge. Green Light.
The Green
Light that Joe just said.
That was the Green Door.
Green
the
Door.
Green Light was over on the west side.
Oh. Oh, right.
We did The Loft.
G Coffee. Daily Grind.
Yeah.
We're going to get back to this list after a short break, and I'm excited. I'm excited to come back to this list, and I'm excited to hear from callers who remember these places and have stories about them. 816-235-2888. You're listening to Central Standard, and we will be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about 90s music, particularly in Kansas City. Although our jumping off point today is based in the fact that Nirvana, that was 20 years ago when Kurt Cobain, the frontman in that band died, and it's tonight that that band will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But we're looking back at Kansas City during the same time period when Nirvana was big, and what were some of the features of the Kansas City sound, if there was a Kansas City sound, which it seems like people are kind of discussing a little bit at 816-235-2888 and through our Twitter handle at KCURCST. We're here with Amy Farrand and Steve Tulipana, and we'd love to hear from you. So, Amy and Steve, we were just remembering some of the some of the hole-in-the-wall kinds of venues that were really important to the scene back then. There were also a lot of influential little record stores at the time. What was the role of the record store in the music scene in those days?
It was a meeting place. It's how you found out about every single thing. Recycled Sounds was, the biggest. I mean, there were plenty. And, you know, and anybody who worked in another record store would get on here and argue that their place was great, too. And that's fine.
Groove Farm was epic. Spiny Norman.
Sure, all of those things. But I think that Recycled Sounds was sort of a hub, you know. And this is before you could get online and Facebook and find out what was happening tonight. You had to go to a place where there was a wall with flyers. You had to go and see what was happening. And everyone did. But there were also places that sometimes you would just go because you knew that no matter what was going on, there was going to be an awesome show. Or even if it wasn't an awesome show, you'd see your friends and, you know, that kind of thing. You'd just show up. And, you know, it was normally more than $2 or $3 at maximum for, like, you know, 20 bands. Nobody got paid at the end of the night. It didn't matter. It was just that. And we were talking about all ages clubs before. I also wanted to say the Outhouse in Lawrence because I'm a punk kid and I love that place. But there at that time, there were also VFW halls everywhere that would allow these young kids to come in and have shows. And we had a VFW hall on 31st Street in Midtown that I would go to see a ton of shows. And I loved it. It was the same deal. Yeah. You'd pay like $2 or $3 to go in and see 8 bands and it didn't even matter. It didn't even matter who was there. You would just show up because you knew your friends would be there and maybe it'd be good. And if it wasn't good, then whatever. You'd go outside and smoke a cigarette or whatever cool things you did at the time.
Do equivalent kinds of venues and characters exist today, or is it a totally different animal now?
They do. There's tons of them. I mean, I go to the coffee shop and I see, you know, there's punk houses and underground stuff all over the. I'm trying to think of some names.
A lot of house show style stuff where people turn their entire basement into a venue whenever they feel like it.
It totally exists. Very cool, exactly really. The same, mm-hmm. almost like to a T.
I want to go to a caller, and yet I have one more question for Amy because Amy, we haven't talked about the bands that you were in at that time, and mm-hmm. there's one of them that I was listening to as a high school kid. The Young Johnny Carson Story.
Yes, the Young Johnny Carson Story. I played drums with those boys. They were a 3-piece, and they asked me to come put some beats behind them, and so I did, and it was fun. It was silly, quirky, goofy stuff.
Tell us about the sound of that band, because that was really its own little thing.
Well, everyone in the band was a songwriter, and so everyone would take turns singing their own songs, and everyone would harmonize with them. We had some great 4-part harmonies, but it was really silly and quirky. People would say it was Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young meets They Might Be Giants.
That's a good
goofy combination of those two things, and it kind of was that. We would do covers of the Gillette commercial. You know what I mean? Gillette, the best a man can get. Like, come on, man. Just silliness.
Well, there have been several spinoffs and different configurations of people in that band. One of them, Foolish Sad Robot.
Yes.
We have a clip from that band. It's very hard to get this music now.
I have it.
Those are on cassette.
I should have. Well, yeah, it is all on cassette. And I had somebody digitize the Young Johnny Carson Story stuff, and it got screwed up, and it only came out of one side. And so I have the digital version of it, but it's just
mono.
It's funny, though.
But let's listen to Foolish Sad Robot to get a sense of the sound.
Okay.
Postpone payback loans. Postscript. Get ripped. Postmodern, it's all over. I got a post-it that tells about it. It said, why is everything so sad and funny? I wish I could be regular or glad.
I wish I could be regular or glad.
Right, that's Tom Levesey.
That's Tom,
yeah, it's Tom. He has the sweetest little voice in the world. His whole personality, everything about him is very kind and he's soft-spoken. Yes. And all the personalities in that band were very different, dramatically different.
Who was listening to you? Who were the fans? What were the venues? Paint the picture for us.
I mean, we played every venue in town. We did all-ages clubs often. We played the Roma Box, it seemed like, every other day.
We're seeing you guys at Harlings.
Yeah, we played Harlings. We played the Bottleneck in Lawrence quite a bit. We went to Lawrence a bunch. we had a rehearsal space at Rumba Box, so we were always there. And if somebody needed a band to fill in, it was easy because we didn't have to drive our gear there. We just have to bring it downstairs. So we would go there, you know, playing a lot of shows.
Let's talk to Scott in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Scott.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Hi, Scott.
I'm good. This is Scott Hobart, and
hi, Scott.
I couldn't not call and say thank you to you guys for all the stuff that you've done over the years in Kansas City for the music. And I just wanted to weigh in on the Kansas City sound. If that, you know, I have a sort of a theory about it. It's sort of geographic, in that at least my experience coming to Kansas City was that, you know, my first experiences with big, good, live, loud music, and we get to see bands, you know, coming from either coast, and Kansas City is just a convenient place. I learned later when, you know, we were touring around with Giant's Chair that you, and Boys Life and all that, that you can, you know, do a figure eight and come back home twice, where some of these other coastal bands didn't get that luxury. But I felt like, you know, we just got to see a wide range, a wide variety of people because of just where we were, you know, and a lot of different sounds coming through here. And I think, you know, to me, the, you know, bands that really helped me understand what it was all about was, you know, Germbox and Molly Maguire and Season of Risk and, you know, Shiner, all these guys. And when I'd hear that stuff live, it just blew me away so hard that, I don't know, it just was big guitars and big melody, really. So I don't know if that rings a bell with anyone, but...
Sure. It's funny, Scott. I made a list last night on the back of my bank statement of bands that I could remember from that time, and everyone you mentioned is on my list. I'm feeling pretty good about that.
I agree with your comment on how we, since we were in the middle, the bands that were here actually got that luxury, but we also did get a lot of bands coming from left and right, north and south, and
right.
Kind of culled all that together. And, you know, I think since we're talking about grunge, I've just get back in my head going, oh, wait, thinking of the bands that stayed at our house, like Coffin Break and Afghan Whigs and Jesus
Afghan
Lizard.
Wigs.
And,
yeah, I don't.
I mean, like Hammerhead. Like, we, you know, you would, all that Midwest camaraderie.
Yeah.
Scott.
Listen forever. That's good.
Yeah, and you made a reference to your band Giant's Chair, and I'm kicking myself because I almost pulled a clip from that band to play and thought that I was going maybe overboard with the clips. But So, what? Tell us about your band.
Well, we were a three-piece, guitar, bass, and drums. Got together basically over at the Art Institute. I came here in '89 to go to school there, and in fact, that's where I remember a buddy of mine, Dave Jones, who was in the singer from Germbox, you know, they just had finished a demo and they brought it back to the dorms. And I heard this cassette and I was like, wow, they're really doing it. You know, this is their music. And it's just, it just tore my head off, you know, and really changed things for me. And, but anyway, we, Byron, the bass player, and I, we had been playing around Kansas City, sometimes as an acoustic duo and sometimes with other guys from my hometown. You know, we would get together once a month and practice and then do shows here at like the Shadow and wherever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I forgot about Monday night at the Shadow was the night.
Yeah. Maybe could someone explain what Monday night of the Shadow is for people who don't know?
The guys at Season of Risk, we kind of took over Monday nights there. I took over. We would bring our own PA in and we would just bring the bands, and that's where Germbox first kind of club, like 21 and over, and Byron and Scott's band would play, and then like that, I just totally blanked out on that until just now.
Yeah.
But Monday night was kind of at the Shadow. They gave us an opportunity to like kind of grow the sound, our sounds.
And the Shadow, if people don't know where that was, it's where America's Pub.
Yeah.
Was
it's where
that
the Bridger's Deli is now.
Yeah, that space. And that used to be a really great club to go see shows. I was underage, but of course we already established that I had a fake ID. So I went in, I got to go to all the shows anyway. So
I'm so sad that we've got just a few minutes left and there are some callers and people on the internet tweeting us who I'd like to get in on the conversation. We've got one person who has said there was a Lawrence sound for sure. Kill Creek Records and bands include Molly Maguire, Paw, Danger Bob, and Frog Pond. Maybe talk about some of those bands and the relationship between the Kansas City and Lawrence music scenes at that time.
I had in my list Paw and Stick together. You know, Frog Pond, that wasn't a Lawrence band at all.
Yeah, I thought that was Kansas City.
It started in Warrensburg. And then they came to Kansas City, so
And Molly was from here, too, all of them.
Yeah.
Well, Scott lived out there for a while.
But Stick and Paul were Lawrence bands.
Yeah. Well, we were all buddies. We all played, traded shows, toured together, and played terrible things together.
Debauchery. But, you know, fun. And then, I mean, as far as a separate Lawrence sound, I mean, like, you know, that's the thing, is we all played
it intermarried. I mean, the Bottleneck was always really good at supporting us. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got some clips from one of the bands that was just mentioned, Molly Maguire. Let's listen to a little bit of the song Humansville, and then we'll talk about that sound.
Good song.
Amy and Steve, what are you hearing? Are you going down memory lane a little bit?
Yeah.
I think they played. They had a little mini reunion at Middle of the Map this last weekend. They're working on a new record. And Ray and Scott came and they played two songs. Maybe they didn't do that one. I can't remember. That was quite a blur. It was a good time. But but hearing that, I'm like, oh, that is kind of grunge. No.
That's so funny. Well, we've got a full switchboard, so I'm going to turn now to Tony, who also wants to talk about the Lawrence sound. Hi, Tony.
Hey, how you doing? I love your show. It's a great topic. Excellent topic, actually. But yes, I was really into Arista recording artist Stick. I mean, I was just so proud of them. I'd follow them to shows in Columbia, Omaha, especially when they had songs on the soundtracks of PCU and Airheads. They were on the Micronauts tribute album. But the last great radio station, aside from KCUR,
of course,
was KLZR. And I miss them on the airwaves. They brought together, they were so proud of the Kansas City and Lawrence scene. They would play Molly Maguire and all these other artists in the regular rotation. And that's about it. But Stick was the band for me that I followed. And through Facebook, you kind of made friends with. Actually, I made friends with a few of the members who aren't really doing music anymore.
Oh, but thanks for that call, Tony.
You bet. Take care. Bye now.
Bye. And now let's turn to Mike in Lawrence. Hi, Mike.
Thanks for taking my call. Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
I saw them about 50 times. You were talking about kind of a Kansas City sound. To me, it always sounded like a cross between a lot of the punk rock bands from Chicago. A lot of Fugazi and a lot of Slant, but that's kind of my take on it. But I know I got a short amount of time, so good hearing about this.
Thanks, Mike.
I know who that was. It took me a second.
Well, what do you think about this idea of our location? Scott Hobart mentioned that, and then this recent caller also mentioned it.
Just what I was saying earlier, it's true. I mean, a lot of those bands came through, and we, you know, you share shows, and you get you share information, and it filters into what you're creating. And
The stopping point for touring bands would always either be Kansas City or Lawrence. Sometimes both. It was rare that people would come through and play both because the shows are so close together. But occasionally, you know, and it was just easy, good stop, good place to fill up your gas tank and eat food before you go on down the line.
Sleep on a floor.
Sleep on somebody's floor. All that glamour.
What about you guys? You know, you were both in bands at this time that were part of this scene. And how were the relationships that you forged in these musical experiments that were pretty involved? Like, how do those shape your current projects and your current endeavors?
I mean, it's all a continuation. I mean, for me, once Seasoned Risk kind of took a break and stopped for a while, I wanted to you know, that's in you, and the thing, the places that you pull from to create art are still there. But you also sometimes like take a right turn or a left turn because you need to experiment those things. And that's, I mean, it's all informed, and it's just life.
Yes. I think that, you know, every person I've ever played with has influenced what I do now, but there is that little reservoir that you tap into. That's the place where your art started to begin with. And you have to be true to that, but you can't do the same thing forever.
Yep.
Nobody wants to hear you do the same thing forever. You don't want to do the same thing forever.
We have a caller who we won't actually have time to get to, but I'll just summarize what she kind of wanted to get at, and maybe you guys can respond to it before we run out of time. She says that in the 90s, there was these venues that were popular at the time, especially the all-ages venues. Mm. You could see the musicians, you could interact with them, and it was a really intimate connection that you forged as an audience member with the musicians. Do you think that that has changed in any way, or do you think that that, too, is a continuation?
I still think it's there. I mean... You know, there's probably, I don't know if there are any of these bands are awake listening, but there's young bands now. If they were, they'd be going, oh, this BS, man. This is just, we just, the whole weekend. Last night I saw six bands over at 47th and Forest. And, you know, or I guess that's where we are. But
we're just too old to know about it.
Well, or, yeah, you know.
We had to go to bed early because we had to be here.
Yeah.
So there's that.
You're too busy, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think there's tons of great underground bands.
I think there's still plenty of interaction at regular clubs, too. That's the thing. If you're playing a circuit of club shows, there's no giant backstage area and nobody ushers you away and hides you from people. Like, you're there. And now, you know, there used to be the time you'd have somebody come and sell your merch. Man, you have to do it yourself now.
You
have to put forth all of this energy, and then you have to sit at the merch table and interact with everyone. That's part of the deal, especially on the road when people don't know you. You know, they call it slapping the skin.
Yeah. There's more interaction, too, with Twitter and Facebook and personal connection, even though it's disconnected, it's connected.
Right.
We're sadly going to have to wrap up this conversation about Kansas City rock in the 1990s.
Ew.
Inspired by the 20-year buzz about Nirvana, that seminal 90s band will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame tonight. Thanks so much to Amy Farrand of the Weirdo Wednesday Supper Club and the Record Bar's Steve Tulipana for being here today. It's been great catching up with you guys.
Thank you, Gina.
Make your pledges.
Yes, make your pledges.
That was unplanned. To listen to today's conversation again or to download a podcast of any of our past shows, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us at the same time tomorrow for Central Standard Fridays with the Kansas City History Series. During tomorrow's show, we'll return to Troost, looking at that storied street from a historical perspective. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Linda Scher is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you've been listening to Central Standard. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.